This is an ABC podcast.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria Digital Radio and the World Wide Web. My co-host today, I have known for many, many years, and you've heard her on this radio program over many, many years, but I've just discovered something new. I had no idea that bookseller and former Age journalist Corrie Perkin is a golfer. Corrie, good morning to you and welcome back.
Good morning, John.
What sort of a golfer is Corrie Perkin? What do you
like? Not a very good one, but it is it's a lovely walk in the park.
Spoiled by a golf ball.
Exactly.
Are you a hack?
No, I'm not a hack. I think I'm a bit better than a hack now, John. I have a handicap.
Thwack. Oh, you've got a handicap.
Well, I was once told by a golf instructor years ago that I would never be able to whoosh. And I said, what does that mean? And he then showed me he did 10 beautiful shots and you could hear it.
Thwack. It's just
and
a
now
wonderful
I can actually whoosh years later.
So you've got a hand, you have a handicap? That's
I have a handicap. Yeah, I have a handicap and I joined a golf club because I think that, you know, for me that's my outlet, really. It's the only thing I do for myself, so I sort of justify it in that way. But the lovely thing about being in a golf club is that you just put your name down with anybody and you meet a whole lot of new friends. And I try and avoid...
You put your name down to play.
Yeah, so
if you haven't got a group,
there's a group of three or four, exactly. Yeah. So you just sort of join in with people. I've met some amazing men and women playing golf.
And afterwards?
And some friends. And then you might have a cup of tea or something afterwards. And I usually go back to the shop because I'll play early in the morning. But it's really fun. But the reason this came up, of course, was because in the ad break, I told you that I saw
in a deer. In the what?
Sorry.
In the news break. This is the ABC.
Of course there are no ads. In the ad break. In the ad break.
This has got off to a great start.
I told you that I'd played golf yesterday with a dear friend of ours and a dear friend of ABC listeners, Ranald McDonald, who used to have the morning show here.
A former presenter, 8:30 till 10 over
several
years.
So, of course, John, as you know, for many years, Ranald's been a friend of mine, and indeed he was a very close friend of my father, who was editor of The Age when Ranald was managing director of The Age.
And so they were close colleagues in
crime. Yes. And there would have been really no... let's be honest, no Graham Perkin, editor of The Age, great period, golden age, without Ranald at the helm, because he was really the one who took the brave decision to appoint it, this young Turk of an editor, and the two of them created magic, and it was a great period in The Age's history, as everybody will remember. But
How old were you when you first met Ranald McDonald?
Probably about seven, I think, six or seven.
So he's been a figure in your life pretty much.
And he was young then, young and unmarried, and Melbourne's most eligible bachelor.
Oh,
and
I remember boom.
I remember he drove a British racing green Mustang.
Yeah, he famously had a convertible Mustang, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And but he was a very good friend of our families, and he was amazing after my father died at the age of 45, which from a sudden heart attack, that was a shock that just sort of sent ripples through not only our family and our friends and, you know, that's those circles, but also The Age itself. And, you know, it was a really sort of the company was completely poleaxed, but it was 3 weeks before Whitlam was sacked. So it was a very important time in newspaper history to keep things going, and Ranald showed amazing leadership. But anyway, Ranald is about to have a significant birthday in a couple of weeks, John.
How significant?
Well, I don't want to, you know, tell everybody how old he is, so I'm not going to say that. That's his prerogative.
What? It's got a zero on the end.
It has a zero on the end.
I remember his 70th, and I know he's not 90.
And I thought, what could I do, little bookseller? You know, I know Ranald and his wife Tricia have a treasure chest of beautiful books, and you know, what could I do? So I asked him to play golf at my golf club, and I asked my brother, who's also, because of family and everything, very close to Ranald, and the former Age journalist Jeff Slattery. So the four of us had a game of golf yesterday. It was very cold. I looked like I was ready to go skiing, you know, at Buller with the hats on and scarves and But we had such a great time, and Ranald was a fantastic golfer. He still is a beautiful golfer, but in his day he was a pennant player, and he was, you know, really, he's been to Augusta, you know, for the Masters, and he's been to all of the major golf tournaments. He has many golfing friends, such as Peter Thompson's been a great friend of Ranald's over the years. And so the golfing stories were thick and fast. And I left them in the clubhouse because I had to go back to work. Mike Clayton, who's also a pro golfer, he was there. He'd played with somebody, a golf course designer from Canada. So, and I left all these chaps around the table. I could have sat there all day. And my brother texted me last night and said, you know, virtually he and Ranald will kind of last out. They had a great time. Thanks very much. Anyway, John.
So they were there all day.
Yeah, but the... The great thing about yesterday, well, I mean, there are many great things. There's a really lovely thing when you lose a parent, and I now have lost two.
And the death of your father was, would it be right to say it's almost like the defining moment of your life, the sudden death of your dad?
Well, you try not to let it define your life, but I think it has, absolutely. Mm. I think that's probably why I'm an insecure person. Well, I am. Don't look at me like that. You know, you'd like you've got you have abandonment issues and all sorts of things, but you try not to let grief.
I've never seen you through that prison.
But
in fact,
I
would have thought the opposite. You are incredibly successful at so many different things that you've done, whether it's as a print journalist or as a broadcaster or as a PR person or as now as a running a small business successfully.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but I think probably if my dad had been alive, he would have said, you know, mops, stick to one thing, like you can jumping around a bit. Jack of all trades, master of none. That was one of his favourite and my mother's favourite sayings. But what I was going to say is that when you lose a parent and you connect up with somebody who knew them in the day and were close to them and all of that, the warmth and the nostalgia, without being sort of soppy and sad, is really familiar and wonderful. And it wasn't that we'd spent 18 holes. I don't think we even mentioned Dad, to be honest, but it was just that familiarity, which was so, yeah, it is. And it's just, it's like when dear friends of my mum's come into the shop and they're now, you know, elegant ladies in their 80s and you have a chat. And sometimes I actually get quite teary because I just think I miss that sort of connection with an 80-something-year-old woman. So it's really special. But what I was going to say is the lead of this whole story is that I
won.
Don't
bury the lead.
I won the comp and I think I'm in the paper today. So
what,
again,
what,
my brother. Well, I don't know in the sports results. I'm not sure. My brother texts me to say, "Oh, your name could be in the paper."
Club golf. Which club are we looking at?
Oh, I can't say that.
Yes, you can.
No,
you,
I can't.
Well, okay. Hang on. I'll turn the microphones off. Are you ready? 1, 2, 3. Okay. Let me have a look.
So, John,
you're not sure.
Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, Steve said that I would be. He texted me and said, your name will probably be in the paper. And I text back and said, that'll be the best byline I have ever had in my 35-year career in journalism.
No, it's not that.
They don't even write Corey Perkin. They just say C. Perkin.
No, you're not even there.
But what was so great is that pretty much everybody who played yesterday was a man.
Except.
Ta-da!
Well, a great injustice has been done because now you don't appear in the scores. So there you go.
And I just want everybody out there to realise that I do work Saturdays and Sundays. So to have Wednesday off is
remarkable. You can do whatever you like.
It's not that the bookshop's just so, you know, fabulous that I can take days off.
While we're paying tribute and singing Ranald McDonald's praises, apart from the fact that he had quite a bit to do with the Collingwood Football Club at one stage, he's been an absolutely champion man. And I think, am I right in saying he's currently heading up the Victorian chapter of the Friends of the ABC?
I think that's his I think that is his role. He's certainly a spokesperson. And gosh, John, you know, that was one topic that we talked about pretty much around the 18 holes of golf yesterday, he and I particularly.
What, the ABC?
Yes.
Oh, what was said?
Oh, well, we all love you. Is that what you want to hear? No.
Not what was said.
Ranald, Ranald and I have had lots of discussions about the ABC in recent years, and in fact we had a couple of ABC, Save the ABC or Friends of ABC type things in our former bookshop where we had the very big event space where we could fit 120 people in. So Ranald will come in often and come in with other guests like Julian Burnside and so on and sing the praises of the ABC. And, with the recent announcement of cuts, according to the most recent federal budget, of course, everybody is very nervous. And in fact, I know you're not allowed to comment on this, but I would just like to say that I can't imagine a life without the ABC.
Not allowed to comment.
I can't imagine a life without Four Corners or Philip Adams Radio National or The Science Show or You in the Morning, John. I can't imagine it. I can't imagine any more cuts. And so the other day I thought, well, it's been a while since I was a paid-up member of the Friends of the ABC, so I got online and I joined up again, plus I gave a donation to the Fighting Fund. So if anybody would like to follow my lead, just go Friends of the ABC and it'll come up. It's really easy. Membership is not all that expensive.
So you've succeeded brilliantly in embarrassing me, having just innocently suggested that one of the things that Ranald does is that he heads up the Victorian chapter of the Friends of the ABC. You've now got me into territory where I'm...
Can I just put in a plug, though? Can I put in a plug? There is a...
It's a lively debate, and it's a debate that's a good one for the ABC.
And there is a really good debate happening, I think. It's in July at BMW Edge, which Ranald has organised.
Oh, okay.
And there are a number of key speakers.
For Friends of the ABC?
Correct.
Oh,
and also to discuss the recent cuts and so on. And there's some rumour that Michelle Guthrie might be there or be...
Well, she's speaking on Tuesday. Next Tuesday lunchtime, she's speaking at a function organised by the Melbourne Press Club. She's been remarkably quiet and reluctant to engage in what she herself previously has described as megaphone campaigning. She says, no, the best way to protect the ABC is to work quietly behind the scenes, and that's obviously delivered a terrible outcome in the last budget round. So whether or not next Tuesday's talk at Melbourne Press Club signifies a rethink on that strategy that's failed, and a determination instead to do what, well, I'm quite happy to say, and if it gets me to trouble, then so be it, but to do what I think the only thing the ABC can ever do, which is tell our own story, because no one's ever going to tell it for us. We tell other people's stories. That's what we do for a living. And we're hopeless at telling our own as an organisation. And we have a managing director who has been deliberately and, she says, strategically silent. Well, that's not worked. We have a chairman of the board who's written one piece for the newspaper that I'm aware of ever and has done a handful of interviews. Also thinks it's strategic to be silent. That hasn't worked. In which case, people who, you know, I've been here since 1989 busting my guts for a vision and a set of values. And quite frankly, I'm sick of seeing it being ripped apart because of the failure of our managers.
Don't give up. Bill Shorten has said that he will reinstate funding if elected.
Well, that's political, and I'm not going to go there.
No,
but
the politicians can
say and do what they like.
Don't forget, Jacinda Ardern has just put in, what was it, 68 mil or 100 mil or something into New Zealand Broadcasting,
so
and
we're
she
not
has
perfect.
Been applauded around the country.
We're not perfect as an organisation, and anyone who works here, we play a game at lunchtime sometimes, if only I could be in charge for just one day. But, you know, there's always ways to improve things, to be more efficient, but fundamentally these cuts are way, way more than about just sort of a nip and a tuck here and there. So, you know, we have to, you know, I've had this conversation with some colleagues. If our bosses think it's strategic to stay quiet, well, at some point we're going to have to say you're wrong. And in fact, there are people who are in jobs like me who deal with politicians all the time and they're laughing at us. They are laughing at the ABC you've been done over.
John, I think the mood is changing. And I just, not off topic, but it really hammers home the impact that budget cuts and it can have on, for example, newsrooms. So I don't know whether you watched a terrific documentary on Sunday night on the New York Times.
Nope.
And it was the first 100 days of the Trump administration.
Oh, I saw it being promoted, but I didn't actually watch it.
Yeah, really good. People can catch up with it on iView.
Good.
The really interesting thing about this is, so we're following reporters in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, the New York head office, the whole thing. They are up to date, like day 45 of the Trump administration, and they are exhausted because every day, every hour, there's a new story to do with Donald Trump. And you just wonder how these newsrooms can, you know, the newsrooms, the way they're holding up the light and shining it in the dark corners of the Trump administration is just is commendable. And imagine, I mean, that's a private company. Oh, no, actually, the New York Times is now on the stock exchange. But imagine if we didn't have the ABC doing this. And the Age has cut, the Australian's cut, Fin Review's cut, everybody's cut, all the journalists. Where would we be without you guys?
Oh, so, it's all right. You've got Twitter. Corey Perkin.
I don't tweet. Do you tweet?
I put the odd joke out every now and again when I think of something that I want to. I don't want someone to plagiarise my work, so I put it out on Twitter so I can claim it. Is that all right?
I'm in a podcast, by the way. I know that you want to get on to the next topic, but can I just say that we need more listeners? It's called Don't Shoot the Messenger.
We need more listeners.
And I do it with Caroline Wilson. Podcasting is a very good way to get your opinion out there. Maybe that could be your next career step.
Oh,
because Don't Shoot the Messenger is what it's called.
Because after this conversation on air, I'm going to need one. 20 past 11 on ABC Radio
Melbourne. And that was John Fain's last program.
Victoria. You heard it here first. This is The Conversation Hour. Corrie Perkin is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today, and we're joined in the studio by Liz Porter. Liz has been a court reporter and crime reporter in this city for about as long as anybody has, but she's turned her hand now to a larger stage and a broader remit. She's written a book called Crime Scene Asia, When Forensic Evidence Becomes the Silent Witness, which picks up on stories beyond just our shores that go with some of the books that she's written about things, similar things that have happened in Melbourne, in Victoria and around Australia. Liz, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Congratulations.
And Corrie.
Why Asia?
Well, just to quote a rather famous politician, it seemed like a good idea at the time, and there were many times over the last few years where I bitterly regretted having decided to do this because with my two previous books, I had a dream run in terms of interviewing people. Forensic scientists were happy to talk to me here and the UK and the US. Cops were keen to talk to me, very cooperative. And when I was in Singapore on a conference, and I thought it would be a good idea because I was in the bookshops and I saw that there was quite a bit of crime fiction around and not much true crime. So I thought foolishly, here's an opening, and went to the equivalent of the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine in Singapore, a place called the Health Sciences Authority, and basically strolled in there. One of the scientists gave me an hour and a half of his time. He was very enthusiastic about the book idea, gave me lots of cases. I went away, got a contract with a publisher. And then when it came time to talk Turkey, suddenly my boss doesn't want me to do this. And that pattern was repeated all around Asia. None of the scientists, except memorably three Philippine women, wanted to talk to me. But thankfully, the lawyers saved me, which is something that you would like to know, John. The defence lawyers
were happy. Because they love a gossip.
They were happy to talk and also hand over documents.
Yes. Well, they want, in particular, if they've succeeded, they
yes.
want the world to know. It's a bit
exactly.
of subtle marketing. But there's cultural issues.
Mm.
I mean, science is science, and forensic science is science. There's no argument about it. But there's culture in how you access information, how people will or won't open up to you, in how it's interpreted, how it's applied and used. So how complicated did that get?
Well, again, not so much because it was just a blanket wall from the scientists and the police. And the Singapore media, or police media chief, was, again, helpful in terms of pointing me to cases. But when I'd finished them, and I wanted him to read them, and I wanted one of the cops that I'd written about to read his story, and maybe he could correct something or add something. And in my experience from Australia and the UK, cops just love to read your stories and draw lines through bits, but they didn't want to read them. I think they didn't want to be associated with them in case it went wrong. So it was a kind of conservatism there, I think.
Liz, do you think it was because of Singapore's closed society?
I suspect so, and but again, it's so closed that in that sense, I was hoping that I could get a journal or two over there to pick up on this idea of why, when the Health Sciences Authority has an overseas journal who's really happy to write in a positive way because they have a great system there, and the cops are actually, it's a police state, well, they're damn good at what they do. I mean, if you want to be murdered somewhere and have your assailant arrested, go to Singapore.
So wearing the bookseller hat...
It's not a great pitch for the local tourism board, Liz.
Well, you know.
Wearing the bookseller hat, Liz, the thing that... Well, a couple of things I love about this book, congratulations, and I'm sorry I didn't come to go to our book club last night. As I told you, I was at home reading your book. I thought, oh, a few chapters, that'll be once over lightly. I was riveted, can I tell you, riveted. So I'm sorry I didn't make book club. I hope you missed me.
We did miss you very much.
You're in a book club together?
Yeah.
Oh, we've known each other for 100 years. Yeah, we used to be desk buddies at the Sunday Age. Anyway, we are in a book club together. But Liz, just so our listeners get an idea of what this book is about, what Liz has done is that each chapter is a particular crime and a murder. And so she's tackled it forensically and looked at how the case was solved due to forensic pathology. And all sorts of everything from investigating people's teeth and dental records through to one of the murder victims had left a water bottle at work, so they were able to obtain her DNA from the water bottle at work and find out more about her. A really, really interesting setup. But each story is like, I would say, like a really wonderful, long, meaty New Yorker kind of Vanity Fair sort of story. And it's great. And it doesn't really matter that it's Singapore or wherever the setting may be. You know, they're fabulous crimes.
It's quite an eye-opener that we've got, I'm a little bit uncomfortable saying this, but we have a bit of cultural superiority, don't we? We sort of think, oh, well, you know, oh, third world countries, Asia, they'll all be corrupt and backward and unscientific. And your book very much suggests the opposite.
I mean, there was some spectacularly bad and biased police work in a Malaysian case, but in fact the judges made up for it. And I have to say, there's also some spectacularly bad police work in the one Australian case that I have in here. It was a Singaporean victim, which is why my Singapore publishers wanted me to run this case. It was a New South Wales case where this unfortunate young man called Ram Tiwari was accused of murdering his two flatmates. And he spent 8 years in a New South Wales jail. And finally, the second appeal trial, he was exonerated. And I'm not aware of any compensation being paid.
Outrageously.
He did write a book, but then, as you say, he disappeared. And
yeah,
he
wrote
talk
his
about
book
it
in Singapore, but it was never covered here. And the case got very little coverage here because he was a Singaporean. If he'd been a white boy, I dare to say, from a wealthy suburb or something like that, I'm guessing he would have been on the front page.
You were saying before that some of the Asian forensic pathologists were reluctant to talk to you, or maybe in the beginning they were, but then there was some silence, can't talk to you, sorry, my boss won't let me. But you did have a couple of breakthroughs with some Aussies who were involved, and I'm thinking of Dr. Johan Duflo and the case of the Singapore massage parlour owner who was murdered and allegedly stabbed her lover, and he sort of lashed out at her in defence. I love that story, but Johan was very open with you, revealed all the facts of the story and the evidence that he'd found. He comes out a superhero. So I'm thinking of all those Singaporean forensics who said to you, no, sorry, can't talk. They must be going, damn, missed my moment in the sun.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have to say my hero from this book is the Australian Federal Police, or former Australian Federal Police scientist David Royds, who was so crucial to the Bali bombing investigation. And I feel so sad for David Royds because he did wonderful work in that. He was the one that identified at the very beginning that this was the work of a suicide bomber. And he talks really frankly with me, because he left the AFP, about the terrible relations between the Australian scientists and the Indonesian scientists, the fact that they had to wait for the Indonesian scientists to process the scene. So he goes into the Paddy's Bar bombing scene, and he's not meant to be there. And he has a cup with him, and he's walking around and he's pretending to drink from this cup. And first he looks at the ceiling and he sees the blood spatter, and he thinks this looks like the work of a suicide bomber. Then he finds this copper wire and secretes it in his cup, takes it away. That night he puts puts it in an envelope in his overalls. And he's exhausted. He's been working all day.
And he steals evidence from the crime scene.
Yes. And then he's been working so hard all day, he's exhausted, and those heavy AFP forensic overalls, and he's lying in his bed in the Katika Plaza in Kuta, and he said the overalls are like a second presence in the room. They are so smelly. He gets up and he washes them. And then the next morning he realises he's actually washed the evidence. And thankfully, on that piece of copper wire was TNT, which is not soluble in water. But if there are other explosives that are, because anyway, so that was saved. And on that, also on that copper wire, were a few tiny threads of fabric that he surmised came from the suicide bomber's vest, and he was absolutely
who in fact had
right.
a tartan vest on.
Absolutely.
But this is an amazing chapter, John, and the stuff that Liz brings together, it's really one of the most compelling overviews of the 2002 Bali bombings that I have ever read. But this scientist, as you're discussing, realised that the way the splatter had occurred, this bomb must have actually been held rather than buried or put on a table or hidden somewhere, it actually must have been at sort of stomach level, as it were. So, I agree. That was a great chapter.
And very interesting to look back on, because initially we forget because we all know it was a suicide bomber. But at the time, nobody wanted to say this because Jamaat Islamia were not yet known to be active in Indonesia, and the Indonesian government didn't want it out there, and the Australian government, being good allies, were also not wanting it out there. And we had to the extent of it being officially denied in the early stages that it was a suicide bomber, and then obviously they later proved that it was. But it was extremely interesting from that point of view too.
Liz, how did you get involved in... I can't remember the day when you first came back to the office and said, oh, dead bodies, this is for me.
And does it have a cumulative effect? I mean, you've spent how long now immersing yourself in this stuff?
Well, the first book came out in 2005, but my first trip to the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine for the Sunday Age, where I saw my first autopsy, my only autopsy, actually, was in 1999.
So does it have a cumulative effect? And what is the attraction, as Corey asks?
Well, it's the solving of puzzles, I think. And it's because people often ask me if I get incredibly upset by the content that I'm reading about. And yes, there's terrible pain and suffering from the victims, from their families. Awful things have happened, and people must think, you know, she's got ice in her veins. But it's not that. It's that you look at it from a different way. I look at it as the scientists do, as the solving of an intellectual puzzle, and the truth is there in the forensic evidence.
But it's also that you're doing for the forensic scientists the storytelling that they're not very good at themselves. They might be good at forensic science, but they're no good at getting us to understand the tricks of their trade, and you are, so you're their go-between.
But also they're not like Liz would be putting together the whole picture.
Yeah,
they're not
right.
following the court cases and subsequent evidence coming from all sorts of directions.
But it's a rare thing to find someone who can put it all into that context, which is why I hope there'll be more and more. Liz Porter's new book is called Crime Scene Asia, and Liz has been a stalwart of the true crime scene and forensic science here and court reporting for decades, as you've just heard. Crime Scene Asia. The subtitle, because every book these days, what is this, Curry? Every second book has a subtitle. What is it? Because they can't come up with titles that tell the story, they've got to have a subtitle?
Well, because with nonfiction, there's got to be a kicker line that kind of explains to the reader who might have the attention span of a flea, this is what this book is called, and by the way, this is what it's about, so this is why you should buy it.
When forensic evidence becomes the silent witness. Crime Scene Asia by Liz Porter. Curry Perkin, bookseller, is our co-host. Kirana Stammel is an actor. She's speaking tomorrow at the Creative States Summit, which is a kind of arts get-together. All the lovies are getting together to try and solve the problems of the world. And her topic that she's speaking about is called The Ugly Duckling and How the Pretty Kids Got All the Cake. Kirana, good morning to you.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm not sure that people hearing the title of your talk will quite understand what it's about.
Well, I suppose I'll just throw it out there to... It's radio, so I've got dwarfism, so I guess as an individual I've always sometimes felt quite different from the norm. But my first, I guess, notable experience of that was in the very first year of primary school when we did a production of The Ugly Duckling and the teacher split the class. So there was that first indication of, oh, those she's picked to play the ducks and those she's picked to play the swans. And I remember sitting with flippers on my feet and a deconstructed feather duster that had given me my feathers along with the other ugly ducks and baseball caps, which were our beaks. And at the end of the play, the beautiful swan, who was beautiful to start with, rose up at the back of the stage and was presented this beautiful chocolate cake, which she got to eat and all the other hot children, sorry, I mean beautiful swans, got to share with her. And I remember thinking, that's okay. We did our bit as the ducks. We'll get to have some cake once the play's over. Play ended. They all got ushered into a separate room to finish the cake and we were denied the cake. And I was like, this is a massive life lesson here that... You know, the ugly ducks didn't get any of the cake, not to mention actually one of the songs we had to sing was Who Stole the Cookie from the Cookie Jar as part of the performance, so the irony's just being piled on. But I remember as this five-year-old feeling this deep-rooted sense of injustice. And so that kind of, I guess, makes the basis really of my talk, that kind of the body fascist lie, I guess, that we were kind of brought up with in society that's perpetuated by the media, film and lots of different, you know, stories that were told. And actually the truth, you know, as a bit of an ugly duck in the real world, I realised is quite different, you know. We're all organic, we're all human, we all deserve love and a slice of the bloody cake.
Well, Kieran, you've had the last laugh on the swans because you're the one with the amazing international career. Congratulations on... What a stellar career you are having.
Oh, thank you. I think a bit of adversity is often a great motivator.
What are you trying to get across at the Creative Summit?
Well, we've been asked to respond to the idea of sort of what's the role of creativity in a post-truth world. So I guess I'm looking at the disabled body or the disfigured body or the ordinary body as truth, and how in this kind of world of Trump and all of these powerful men who are all married to beauty queens, who don't, you know, speak but pose, that there's kind of, I guess, a juxtaposition of the disabled body, which is often denied access to the spotlight and to storytelling or even just being present in ordinary storytelling across the board, that actually there's a truth in that body that's a really interesting point of view to kind of come at when you're sort of looking at this world of self-promotion, selfies, that everybody's kind of photoshopped, that I'm kind of really putting the juxtaposition of that forward and the need to represent vulnerability, which is, you know, I guess kind of present in the disabled body, and to kind of go, let's embrace that and allow that in our lives and in our storytelling for the mental health actually of everyone, including those whose bodies are totally average. Because if you embrace the vulnerable body and go, do you know what? They deserve access to the spotlight and to be present and to tell stories, whether they be about disability or not, you actually empower the ordinary individual because they go, I'm also allowed to be vulnerable or to become ill or to, you know, have an accident. Like, it's very, I think personally it's really healthy. If you go down sort of the Gattaca line of, oh, we're going to just erase out and never allow anybody whose body deviates to ever speak or to ever tell a story or to ever write a book or to participate in politics, you create a world of paranoia. Because, you know, everyone that was part of the Aryan race was terrified of falling off the wagon themselves, you know, because there but by the grace of God go I. Whereas I think, you know, if you make life or tell the story and create understanding for somebody who's different, you actually kind of go, phew, we're all okay.
Well, there's a real genre at the moment. I'm thinking of television in particular, which is an area that you've worked a bit in too, as well as stage and film. You know these shows so well, Liz. You know the cop who has, you know, a significant emotional issue. Mm. And even, for example, I'm thinking of The Bridge, which was on SBS, a fantastic series.
The Asperger's.
Yeah, and Saga, yeah. And she's...
Standy crime.
And she might be what Kieran calls, you know, the beautiful swan. Mm. or the beautiful princess character, but she was tormented by her own demons. And you're right, you know, she made us feel that we could actually confront some of our vulnerabilities and so on. But the tortured cop is just like now, you know, Vera has an alcohol issue. It's incredible, isn't it, how this genre's sort of taken off in the last 3 or 4 years.
And also the absolute weirdo forensic scientist. They're always... eccentric is a very kind way of putting it.
Oh, well, I definitely see you've got sort of visible impairments and invisible impairments, but invisible impairments become a problem when they're visible. So when, you know, they're going to occur and create judgment from other people, or when an individual needs to out themselves in order to kind of access support services or get within the story, you know, the support they need for their alcoholism or understanding from their colleagues to know that, you know, they're autistic, so what they say and how they might immediately respond will need a little bit of extra interpretation because they're not neurotypical, and a little bit of extra flexibility. So I definitely see the connection between the kind of inner when the inner becomes outer, but also actually, you know, as a woman with a physical impairment, I find it really frustrating that when you've got an impairment that affects the brain, that somehow it becomes this ethereal other thing. But the brain is as organic and anchored in the human body, and it's just another organ that, you know, experiences of mental illness, experiences of being non-neurotypical shouldn't get put in this special category, because they're as rooted in our physical structure as my dwarfism is in my skeletal structure. Like, it's not special because it's kind of, oh, it's the mind. You know, dementia and all of these things are just extensions of, you know, the disabled community.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% there. With this Creative State Summit, I'm really interested in this idea of everybody coming together and discussing a way forward. What are you hoping, though, will be the actual concrete outcomes of this? Are you hoping that, for example, script writers might think about having characters that may have some sort of physical or emotional disability, and that's just kind of part of the, it's not the action, but it's part of the story? Or are you hoping that artists will pick this up as a theme with their work? Or what are you actually hoping to encourage?
I would like to encourage the inclusion and empowerment of disabled people to be present in storytelling, whether it be incidental, whether it be in a lead role, whether it's just the shopkeeper is somebody that is blind or deaf or a wheelchair user, and for people to realise that disability doesn't inherently mean anything. Like, for example, you know, my dwarfish body is not a metaphor for emotional underdevelopment. A character being blind should not be a metaphor for somebody's emotional inability to see. That disability and difference just is.
In fact, it's often the other way around, isn't it? You might have a diminished sense of one type, which then means, you know, blind people have acute hearing is notoriously well known.
Yeah, well, they've something compensates. Yeah.
And emotionally, they're sometimes far more aware and far more tuned in, because they're missing one of their senses, or if you're deaf, you have much better tactile.
Well, yeah, often a vulnerability does mean that you actually become emotionally more aware of situations. Like, I find, just because of my size, I can sense whether a room or a pub's getting a bit dodgy or a bit violent, like, way before somebody else does, that you start to go, ooh, you know, there's a bit of an aggressive vibe. I'm going to get out of here, because actually if it kicks off, I'm not going to be able to get out of here. So there is that natural kind of, I think vulnerability does make you quite emotionally attuned to the environment around you.
It's almost Darwinian, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think for me it's just that we've as humans for some reason decided certain people are freakish, so they'll only be shown in that kind of context. But actually the real stories are, like, in real life I'd be a doctor, a lawyer, a wife, a mother, yet for some reason in theatre, film, and actually often novels, it's like, oh, but you wouldn't, would you? Because what does it mean? And
you're like, it's turned into a freak show.
Yeah, so I'm like, I'm much more about representing the truth. And so that for me is my hope for the summit, that actually we explore, well, you know, in this world where everything is pretty much fantasy anyway, or mistruth, or, you know, people are misleading or misspeaking or airbrushing or faking or polishing, that actually we kind of go, do you know what, there's something inherently honest in the human body that is different, so we need to start, you know, actually exploring the truth of those stories.
The Creative States Summit is on at the Melbourne Museum today and tomorrow. It's on creativity in a post-truth world. And Kieran Estamel, actor, is speaking on The Ugly Duckling and how the pretty kids got all the cake. You can go to the Creative States Summit website. In fact, many of these sessions are being streamed. Liz Porter's book is called Crime Scene Asia, and Corey Perkin has been my co-host.
Thank you, John.
Despite not getting her name in the paper for her golf victory yesterday.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.